Produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Free Culture Radio. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. An article published March 12th in JAMA, the journal formerly known as the Journal of the American Medical Association, entitled Adolescent Delta 8 THC and Marijuana Use in the U.S. To discuss the findings, on Zoom with me now is the lead author, Alyssa Harlow, Ph.D., an assistant professor of clinical population and public health sciences at the Keck School of Medicine of the University of Southern California. Dr. Harlow, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Now, before we get started, for the benefit of listeners, you know what? No, honesty is the best policy. This is for my benefit. What the heck is Delta 8 THC?
You know, it's a great question. And I had the same reaction when I first heard about Delta 8 about 3 years ago. I said, what the heck is this? I need to look into this. You know, as a drug researcher, someone who has predominantly been in the tobacco world, but has an interest in the evolving cannabis market, I was very interested in this, you know, novel product that we were starting to see. So Delta 8, it's an intoxicating cannabinoid. It's a minor cannabinoid that's naturally present in cannabis plants. So it's naturally present in very low concentrations in both what we would consider marijuana, which is cannabis with higher concentrations of Delta 9 THC. And it's also naturally present in hemp, which is a cannabis plant that's legally defined as containing low concentrations of Delta 9 THC. So technically, hemp has less than 0.3% per dry weight of Delta 9 THC. Delta 8, it's an isomer of Delta 9, which means they have very, very similar chemical structures, and they produce very similar psychoactive effects. The difference is the legal context with which we are seeing Delta 8 products and Delta 9 products. In 2018, the federal government legalized hemp and hemp-derived products. And so what we have seen since 2018 is really a proliferation of new hemp-derived cannabis products on the market, the most common of which really has been Delta 8. And these products come in the form of gummies and vape products. We sometimes see dry flower, and they produce similar effects as what we would think of as traditional cannabis products. But they're being marketed as federally legal, and they're being sold online and in gas stations and convenience stores and vape and smoke shops, really with very little regulation.
Now, considered legal, that technically speaking, they're not prohibited? I mean,
trust me, it is confusing. It's confusing for me as somebody who has studied this. So the legal status of Delta 8 is it's contentious. So, and it also depends on the state. So hemp is legal federally. That being said, most of the Delta 8 products that we're seeing on the market have been chemically synthesized from CBD. Because Delta 8 is present at such low concentrations in cannabis, in order to get the amount that we're seeing that would actually produce an intoxication or a high, manufacturers are chemically synthesizing Delta 8 from CBD. So now that's where it gets a little tricky, because technically the DEA has said that any type of synthesized THC is illegal. So that's why at the federal level, they are considered both legal and illegal, depending on who you talk to. But ultimately, there's very little federal oversight and little federal regulation. And then in lieu of federal regulations, we've seen a number of states come forward and actually implement their own restrictions and laws related to Delta 8. So some states, like your own Oregon, have outright banned Delta 8. Other states have implemented restrictions. So, for example, implementing minimum age purchasing laws, or requirements for testing or packaging, labeling, potency caps, things like
Weed was so much simpler back in the 20th century.
that.
I'm sorry, let's get back to the interview. Okay, now what was the question you were looking into?
So, in this study, we were interested in estimating how common Delta-8 use is among youth in the United States. And we were also interested in whether the use was different based on sociodemographic characteristics, as well as state-level cannabis policies and region.
So what did you find?
Well, we found. We were a bit surprised to find that more than 11% of 12th graders across the US had used Delta-8 in 2023, and that use was significantly higher in states where there was not adult use cannabis legalization and in states where there were no Delta-8 regulations. And we also found use was highest in the South. And the Midwestern US census regions.
How does that compare to sorry, this I'm still wrapping my head around it. How does that compare to use of regular marijuana, the illegal stuff?
So in the same study, we did also study marijuana for a comparison, and we found that it was around 30%. Of 12th graders had used regular marijuana. So definitely a higher percentage, but still the fact that these Delta-8 products have really only been around since 2018. The fact that we were seeing 11% of youth was a little surprising. That's an appreciable, what we were calling an appreciable, significant proportion of teenagers who have used these products. But the difference is we did not see that marijuana use varied based on cannabis policies. So the use was very similar for youth, regardless of whether they lived in a state with legalization. But we saw Delta-8 was predominantly concentrated in areas where there were no, where there's not cannabis legalization.
I suppose on one hand it makes sense because marijuana, I mean, it's illegal for kids, and whether it's an illegal state or not, but
And it's not that surprising that we saw this variation for Delta-8 because, I mean, I am inundated with marketing from these products because I research this. And so all of the algorithms, they're constantly showing me marketing from these products. And if you see the way that a number of these products are being marketed, it's not surprising that you might see greater use in areas without legal cannabis because they're a main marketing strategy is that are these claims of it being a legal substitute for marijuana? And so it makes sense that we might see that market concentrated in areas where there is not legal cannabis.
one of the things that interests me, I don't know if you've looked at it, and I doubt you have. It would be the is the I mean, with we have these synthetic research chemicals, synthetic cannabinoids that Spice and Kush and K2 that a decade and a half ago were getting a lot of attention, and I you know we legalization. I mean, you don't find that stuff in a place like Oregon. We have legal weed. Why would you bother? You don't find hemp cigarette. You don't find hemp joints in Oregon either, because why bother? This is okay. Back to the interview that I'm just started to ramble. What are the policy implica What are the policy implications?
Yeah, so I think our study provides very preliminary evidence that there is lower use in states that have implemented regulations or restrictions on Delta-8. And I say preliminary because our study was not really designed to estimate the causal effects of these policies, but it at least provides evidence that there is variation by region and that there's lower use in these states that have implemented regulations. And so I think that it points, it's a positive step forward and it's encouraging that additional regulations of Delta-8, could help curb youth use. But we definitely need more research that can inform regulations and specific policy strategies that can be implemented to really encourage a safer and regulated hemp market.
Of course, and you're using Monitoring the Future data for the for your basic research. So we know that's a long time. That's been over that. That's a lot of data. So curious now. Did you have a did you end up looking at any of the synthetics, or was that way outside your remit?
We did not look in this study at any of the other synthetic cannabinoids. But yeah, it's interesting. It's possible that there may be some similar patterns of use, as you mentioned. I think, another interesting thing that we didn't look at in this study, but I've been studying e-cigarettes now for 6 years and the novel nicotine product. And I think there's just some similar kind of parallels with the vaping market and what we're seeing with Delta-8, in that manufacturers are always going to identify policy loopholes and come up with new products that can be sold without regulation. And so, coming from a tobacco control perspective, this is something that I've seen with e-cigarettes for years, is the federal government implements some kind of regulation. So they ban flavors in cartridges of Juuls. Okay, all of a sudden we see disposable vapes now become the new product. We see a regulation on disposable vapes. Now we see synthetic nicotine popping up. And so I think it is just kind of interesting with Delta-8. And so it's very similar, although it's instead of in response to policies, it's almost in the absence of policies. We're seeing these products, pop up as these sort of alternative products that can kind of serve as a substitute for what people may be in demand for.
I know this is off topic, but you mentioned I need to ask about the synthetic nicotines.
So the FDA, until recently, has author had authority to regulate nicotine and tobacco products. And tobacco products were defined as any product that's made or derived from tobacco. And so what ended up happening was manufacturers realized, well, we can create synthetic nicotine that is not derived from tobacco. So we can make nicotine in a lab, we can label it as being tobacco-free, and we can escape federal regulation. Now, we've caught up, the FDA has caught up, and now they define a tobacco product as any product that contains nicotine from any source. But it's just an example of these kind of policy scapegoats that we often see in the nicotine world. And I think we're now starting to see this with this intoxicating hemp market. So I think that we can learn from tobacco control research. Maybe we can at least learn some lessons.
This is fascinating. I know you have a bunch of other stuff to get to, and I'm very grateful to you for your time this morning. What have I not yet asked that I should have?
I think, we didn't really touch on what some of the unique harms of these products might be. So Delta-8 and intoxicating hemp products, they're gonna pose similar risks as traditional marijuana, which I'm not gonna get into here. But of course, for youth, we don't want youth using cannabis. But I think that Delta-8 poses unique harms as well that directly stem from their lack of regulation. So one is that there's no federal minimum purchasing age for hemp products. So while some states have said, yeah, you have to be 21 to buy these products at the federal level, there's no minimum purchasing age. So that's a concern. There's no requirements for testing of these products for contaminants. And as I mentioned, almost every Delta-8 product that you see out there has been chemically synthesized. It's gone through a chemical isomerization process from CBD. And so there's no standard protocols for testing those products for residual contaminants. And the fact that many of these products are inhalable, that is particularly concerning. There's also a lack of standards for marketing and packaging and warning labels. So I think there's a real concern, if people are familiar with CBD and they know that CBD is not really intoxicating, it doesn't get you high. And so if they're associating hemp with being a sort of non-intoxicating product, and then there's no standards for having cannabis warning symbols or instructions or doses, there's a concern for accidental exposure, and, especially if they're being sold in convenience stores, right, or gas stations. And then another thing that I think is just kind of interesting that's not really talked about a lot is that Delta-8 and some of these other minor cannabinoids, they occur at naturally very, very low concentrations in the cannabis plant. But what we're seeing now is people are extracting those cannabinoids at incredibly high concentrations. And so we don't know what the health effects of taking these minor cannabinoids at such higher concentrations would be. And so I think that's, another just sort of interesting and potentially concerning thing to look out for.
Right on. And then there's, as you're saying, the possibility of contaminants, and plus there's whatever else is being added with the vape products. You have diluents, you have viscosity agents, you have flavorings, and all of these. So, sorry, going off now. How can people keep up with your work? Do you have a website, social media, that kind of thing?
So I'm a faculty member that's part of the USC's Institute for Addiction Science. So you can follow the IAS, the Institute for Addiction Science, on all the social media channels. I'm also the co-director of a research lab here called Rebel Research. It's Real World Evaluation and Behavioral Epidemiology Lab. So we have a website. I think it's rebelresearch.usc.edu. So you can follow us there. And we're conducting research on a lot of novel nicotine and cannabis products. And so, follow us and keep up with our research. And thank you so much, Doug, for your interest.
I appreciate it. Do you have any closing thoughts for the listeners?
Just that I think it's important for people to be aware of the intoxicating hemp product market, know that these products are out there, know the risks, and I'd really just like to advocate for consumers to really know what they're using and what the risks are associated with it.
Right on. My guest has been Professor Alyssa Harlow, PhD, lead author of an article entitled Adolescent Delta-8 THC and Marijuana Use in the U.S. that was published March 12th in JAMA. Dr. Harlow, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
We'll be back with more in a moment. You're listening to Free Culture Radio. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Welcome back. The UN's Commission on Narcotic Drugs holds its 67th session this year, March 14th through 22nd, in Vienna, Austria. The president of Colombia, Gustavo Petro, addressed the CND on March 14th.
Distinguished authorities, ladies and gentlemen, distinguished delegates, greetings from Colombia, the epicenter of the war against drugs for half a century. The International Drugs Control System, with the center of gravity in Vienna, has failed. The latest World Drugs Report, issued by the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime, indicates this. Illicit drugs are in easy reach of all, while controlled medicine does not reach the patients in greatest need. In other words, this global, anachronistic, and inert system has failed to destroy the market for illicit substances, nor has it helped strengthen the market for licit medication. It insists on pitting the state against the market, and in so doing jeopardizes our countries and our people. The war on drugs has failed principally for the following reasons. Firstly, the rising use of fentanyl in the United States, leading to over 100,000 dead this year. Two, 1 million murders perpetrated in Latin America, the most violent region of the world, because of the criminalization of drugs. Thirdly, Tens of millions of detainees throughout the drugs trafficking chain, including the peasant workers producing coca leaves. Fourthly, the destruction of democracy because of corruption and the armed overthrow of territories by criminal organizations in Latin America. The health of our societies is at stake. The risk posed by the use and abuse of illicit drugs, both natural and synthetic drugs, can only be mitigated by adopting a harm reduction policy that focuses on a public health approach. Colombia calls on the membership of the Commission on Narcotic Drugs to place the right to health at the center of your debates. The health of our democracies is at stake. The drugs mafias that are created as a result of prohibition and criminalization move their money to the north, benefiting from the financial systems controlled by large capitals and leaving the south wrecked by violence and destruction. They don't want strong institutions that can stand up to them. They don't want empowered or educated people with their basic needs being met. What they want are poor and weak people in institutions to corrupt them. They need our people to remain poor in order to compel them to cultivate, produce, and traffic. Colombia calls on the Commission of Narcotic Drugs to recognize that arms trafficking, money laundering, and corruption are part of the motor driving the global phenomenon of illicit drugs. Colombia implemented all of the wrong formula that were imposed on us from abroad to engage in a war on drugs. This led to deaths. We gave our armies and police forces an impossible task. We wasted our budget resources. We turned our peasant communities, our indigenous and Afro-descendant communities, into enemies. We violated rights on a massive systematic basis. We continued to destroying our ecosystems, and we sacrificed our own development for a war being waged by others. What the world calls the world drugs problem reflects more than anything else the isolation of millions of peoples living in developed societies who are addicted to drug use and the lack of opportunity in communities within illicit economies. There is no drugs problem. There is a problem of development and of existence. The denialist mindset that still persists in the view of the failure of the multilateral drug system is forcing countries to respond through a flexible interpretation of conventions. Colombia is doing this on two levels. Internally, our national drugs policy places the fundamental rights of all Colombian people at the heart of our actions. The coca leaf is part of our history. The coca leaf is not the problem that we have here in Vienna. Let us give breathing space to the peasant workers who cultivate coca leaves, and rather let us tackle those who are growing rich from trafficking in cocaine. This drugs policy is embedded in a quest for achieving total peace, both within and beyond our borders, peace with local communities, peace with nature, the right to life above all. Internationally, Colombia has launched a process to recast the manner in which we address the world drugs problem. We are starting in our region of Latin America and the Caribbean, and we wish the rest of the world to engage in this debate. A former president of the United States said, and I quote, "With the United Nations when possible, without the United Nations when necessary," end of quote. We believe that we must do everything with the United Nations, but not with a United Nations that fails to hear, see, and remain silent.
That was President Gustavo Petro of Colombia addressing the UN's Commission on Narcotic Drugs March 14th during its 67th session in Vienna, Austria. Simultaneous interpretation was provided by the United Nations. Here's Jessica Morales with the Latin American Network of People Who Use Drugs, speaking at a roundtable discussion March 15th.
Distinguished Chair, Excellencies, Ladies and Gentlemen, my name is Jessica Morales and I am making this intervention on behalf of the International Network of People Who Use Drugs Input and the Latin American Network of People Who Use Drugs Lamput. We are global and regional entities representing the voices of people most impacted by drug policies. It is indisputably clear that the current international drug control system, mandated through the three drug control treaties, impedes and obstructs human rights, the right to life, right to health, and right to freedom from discrimination, being just a chief few that are consistently denied people who use drugs the world over. Over time, it has become more evident that the war on drugs also undermines indigenous and cultural rights, as well as the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination. It is time for the global community to be honest about our failures. The war on drugs fuels racism, oppression, and neocolonialism. I come from a region that continues to be plundered of its resources and where our people have continued to witness rampant violence and enforced disappearances by a system that has continued to traumatize generations since colonial times and will continue to do so. All over, the imperative to control and punish drug use, which has always been a part of the human experience, is creating new threats and challenges, such as a poisoned drug supply and exponential increases in drug overdoses. Lives are being lost every day, lives that have value, loss that could have been prevented. Our fight is for life, for its preservation, for everyone. The way forward. The path to 2029 must entail a paradigm shift where the human rights and dignity of people who use drugs must be placed front and center. It is our communities who are being decimated, our communities who are grieving, and our communities who are at the front lines of mitigating the damage caused. The global architecture on drugs should not primarily entail reporting back on military and police crackdowns, arrest and violence, but focus on righting the wrongs. To this end, member states should work on full decriminalization and responsible regulation, drawing from community, indigenous, and cultural knowledge and practices, and ensure people who use drugs are meaningfully involved every step of the way. Gracias.
That was Jessica Morales with the International Network of People Who Use Drugs and the Latin American Network of People Who Use Drugs, speaking during a roundtable discussion March 15th at the 67th session of the UN's Commission on Narcotic Drugs. And for now, that's it. You've been listening to Free Culture Radio. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. We'll be back in a month to continue our examination of drugs, drug cultures, and the influence of drugs on society. Thanks again for listening. This is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long!